I just saw the latest Indiana Jones, The Dial of Destiny.
No spoilers.
Never. I would die first.
Like face melting day?
No, Walter Donovan. It's just something you say.
Fine. Just tell us if you liked it then.
Well, I said this on social media, but my review is this. I don't need much more from the franchise than this. Harrison Ford. And that delivered. Then you've got punching Nazis, also check, exaggerated treasure lore and mucked up ancient history with a witty and somewhat salty educated female scholar, check, check, and check again. Set that all to a John Williams score and I am in.
Well, Crystal Skull still sucked.
Your mom sucked. Wait, sorry, Brian's mom. I know you listen to this podcast. I apologize. Brian, don't you dare insult Harrison Ford. He is a national treasure.
He belongs in a museum.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
So what do you think about the new Willy Wonka movie?
I'd follow Timothy Chalamet anywhere.
See, I don't know. Do we really need to turn that whole story into a fandom?
Time will tell. While I think it's fun how storytellers use characters and universes created by other storytellers, put their spin on things, I do sometimes think people can take it a little too far.
Define too far.
Well, Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean franchise comes to mind. Well,
I'm going to take on your role here and sympathize with Disney. You got some good bones to the story. You want to milk it all you can, you get every drop of fun out of it. Wait, actually. Petition to not use the verb milking or the idea of getting every drop within 500 yards of Johnny Depp.
Granted and fair, the world could have done without at least two of the pirate movies. And I say that as a fan. I'm one of those crazy Disney adults. Everyone knows this. I'm like one step away from wearing puffy paint Mickey Mouse sweaters all the time. I want my ashes spread on the pirates ride. But the woke fascists at Disney and their crazy rules and boundaries shut down my dying wish.
Well, I will take your point on that franchise. Taking things too far. Today, we're going to talk about Mormon fandom world and how far we take that story.
Can't stop, won't stop until we get to Kolob. That should be a hymn.
You said it on Euro Polygamy, but it's worth saying again. After Joseph Smith died, each subsequent prophet's job was just to recreate the restoration.
It's definitely what fundamentalist breakoff sects are always trying to do. Restore the restoration. Recreate that experience. Don't know how to move theology into the future, Mormons? No worries. Move it closer to the past. Why? Well, as Mormons,
what we do best.
There's something to be said about prophets of Mormonism in the latter days trying to recreate the nostalgia of the past. For example, you got your Joseph Smith, played by Gene Wilder. You've got your Brigham Young, played by Johnny Depp. Solid move connecting those two, by the way. You've got your John Taylor, played by Timothy Chalamet. Et voila! A solid Mormon fandom is born. We'll cracker milk soup that thing for ages.
I'm not sure that that tracks, but I appreciate your point. It's especially relevant today as we talk about the Trek West. Mormons love their Trek stories. Raise your hand if you've been a Mormon anywhere around the world and worn a pioneer dress at least one time in your life.
All the hands are raised in the room, except mine. I was so sadly in Belize when that nonsense took place. Trek, the Comic-Con for Mormons who like to LARP as pioneers.
Trek is essential to the Mormon heritage experience, especially in the United States, as any modern Mormon knows. That's part of the Mormon fandom that we keep trying to recreate over and over again.
While you walk and walk and walk.
And Brigham Young wasn't even shy about it. He told on himself. Read that quote of his.
I have traveled with Joseph 1,000 miles as he led the camp of Israel. I have watched him and observed everything he said or did. And for the town of Kirtland, I would not give the knowledge I got from Joseph from this journey. And then you may take the state of Ohio and the United States, and I would not give that knowledge for them. This was the starting point of my knowing how to lead Israel.
Brigham Young would try to recreate Camp of Israel, and after him, the challenge of every good prophet was to recreate the good old days of persecution and unity that Joseph Smith brought to the table. The Mormon prophets didn't really know how to do Mormonism if they weren't under pressure from someone, if there weren't some outside enemy. Brigham Young tries to recreate Camp of Israel and fashions himself as Moses, leading people into the West. Moses, Moses, Moses. That was a fun sequel to Joseph Smith's reign. And then John Taylor took on the U.S. government with the underground period, and that was a decent part of the trilogy. And then Wilford Woodruff gave it the good old college try, but it was hard to conjure up enemies in the 20th century.
While the 20th century gave us gays, feminists, and intellectuals as the outside enemies, Brethren had been milking those villains in the fanfic for some time. Goodness, you're all about people milking things tonight, aren't you? Listen, I'm sorry that one cow didn't keep sweet last time.
Hey, if we're going to milk things, let's throw communism in there at some point. Milk the sweet teats of communism. Mormons don't know how to Mormon if they aren't being persecuted. It's just a key component to the canon.
Persecution and suffering, Mormonism's OTP.
Luckily for us, there's plenty of persecution on the trail and in Brigham Young's sequel. There's no punching Nazis, but you can pretend that in Brigham's head, he's got a John Williams score in there kicking around as he recreates the Camp of Israel and leads his people into the Promised Land. No one left to go, the devil he had won. He said to me, it's gonna rain now, rain now. Real quick, before anyone gets led anywhere, we need to check in with our friends at Signature Books. George Hugh Cannon is generally acknowledged as second only to Brigham Young as the most visible leader of Mormonism in the mid to late 19th century. He became Young's protege and was an influential first counselor in the First Presidency of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for almost 25 years, serving with presidents Brigham Young, John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, and Lorenzo Snow. Known as the spokesman for the kingdom, Cannon was a central political figure of the church, not only serving as Utah's territory delegate to Congress for 10 years, but also as chief political advisor and long-term editor of the Deseret News. Cannon helped shape doctrine, church governance, and administration during a period of significant change, defending and promulgating plural marriage both before and after the 1890 Manifesto. He was at the center of business life in Salt Lake City, serving as president of the largest publishing house, banks, a railroad, mining companies, electric companies, and other businesses. Though Cannon was loved and revered by his people, controversy sometimes touched his life and family. George Hugh Cannon, politician, publisher, apostle of polygamy, by Ken Cannon, new from Signature Books. Get it at Benchmark Books or be punished by being a pioneer child who has to sing.
All right, kids, let's see how well you've been studying for the test. Class, when the saints leave Nauvoo, where do they go next?
To Zion.
I need you to be more specific, Ms. Park.
Well, they first settled outside of Nauvoo in Iowa Territory.
Again, more specificity here. We just went over this all of last season.
Okay, you've got the big ones, the big three, Garden Grove, Mount Pisgah, Council Bluffs, the holy trinity of winter quarters encampments. But these were only three of some 55 temporary settlements strung along the Missouri.
Well, there's also the five successive headquarter camps, Grand Encampment, Cold Springs Camp, Cutler's Park, Winter Quarters, and Canesville.
Five! Throw in two more and you get top level of the Celestial Kingdom.
Yeah, Lauren Willie sees what you did there. In this region, Mormons occupied areas all over the place, set up three ferries, and farmed at least 15,000 acres of land while they waited to head farther west.
But by spring of 1847, the Saints were itching to get out of winter quarters and get on with their lives. And to be honest, we are too.
Is it time to leave our grand encampment? Can I say, Mormon bots, roll out?
Hastings Immigrant Guide says yes. Okay, if we're talking fandoms today, I want to recreate my fave.
Sure. We doing My Little Ponies or Golden Girls?
Oh, shoot. Okay, my third fave, Oregon Trail. You obviously remember this game because we bring it up all the time.
Sadly, every time we bring it up, we're dating ourselves. Folks of a certain generation, the best generation, the one where we were all generals in heaven. We are the only ones that remember this old PC game. ONPS, my children.
This depresses the hell out of me. Listen, youths, back in our day, we didn't get on some portable PC called an iPhone and doom scroll for 45 minutes on how to contour our cheeks, booty shake, and build a greenhouse out of used pellets. No, we were too busy being important heroes in our own pioneer stories.
All right, I can see we're going to need a primer on Oregon Trail here.
For the youngsters.
So step one is you go to computer lab. Barring that, you go actually on the DOS archives on the internet and play it on your computer now. It's fantastic.
It really was in between math and English. You got to go down for an hour computer time after you did your typing. You got your Oregon Trail time.
That green and or orange screen is burned into my memory.
I never had orange. It was always green.
It's a shame. It really is. All right. So what you do, you pick your family. You get, I believe it was six people, and I can't remember if it was this way in all of the versions, but in some, you could pick your names. So, you know, you definitely wouldn't name yourself Poop or Fart or anything like that because you were mature.
It was like Butt Munch family.
Yeah, it was that way. So you pick your people, you pick your occupation, you pick what time of the year you left, and then you had to buy some supplies. And at the outset, it was very important because you definitely needed oxen, of course. You needed clothes. You needed some food, but no. What you bought was a buttload of bullets. Absolutely every box of bullets that the game would let you.
And some flour.
No.
Some flour. We knew. Well, that's
true.
Nothing
but buffalo gold.
You didn't need flour if you had bullets.
No. And you could trade along the way, which was sometimes helpful. But let's be honest. The only reason you played Oregon Trail was to go hunting. That was the best part.
Okay, so now that the youngsters are all caught up, let's pretend you're currently sitting in your elementary school computer lab and you've waited all day to build your own Oregon Trail Butt Munch family. You pick the number of people in your group, you start buying your supplies. And that's the fun part, the buying supplies.
I forgot, you had to buy extra wagon parts, because those were super helpful. Because you'd get 30 miles out of Independence there, and your axle would break, and you're like, really? Come on. I built that thing.
Some of us knew better because, like, if you were new to Oregon Trail, let's say you moved to the school from somewhere on the East Coast, God help you. You didn't know that you were supposed to leave in the spring. If you chose any other time, you'd die right out the gate. And then, if you're like going to the store and you get caught up in fancy dresses or whatever, like, you're going to die. Rookie mistake.
And I don't know if people always appreciated the gamble of caulking your wagon to float it across. They're like, no, we'll go on the ferry.
Oh, yeah, you could choose if you were going to caulk it to travel across the river. And why did we do all of this, Brian? We do this so we don't die. That's why. Because, especially as Mormon kids, we knew that we have to get our GD families to the promised land without anyone dying. And if that sounds bleaker than doom scrolling it on TikTok, you're damn right it is. Because back in my day, we like to suffer on our electronic devices, just like our pioneer foremothers.
Just one fun memory along those lines. Sometimes people did die. And I believe this was only in later versions you got to write the tombstone. And of course, my brother and I would use that opportunity to write my sister's name and the boy that she hated as her boyfriend, because the game would save that. And any subsequent party that passed by got to see the tombstone.
I remember reading other people's tombstones. That was a fun time.
Again, you would definitely never say anything offensive about somebody in your class or anything like that.
Or your teacher's name was never.
You would never do that. Mm-hmm. So. And see, the suffering that was there was part of the fun. Maybe it's just fun for Mormons because we really like talking about suffering. Who doesn't know about the suffering our ancestors went through to bring us the gospel today?
I know when it comes to historically mistreated groups and suffering, several ones. I don't know, like maybe the Jews or like Mormons. Can you not? Descendants of those that were enslaved are like Mormons, seriously? Can you not? And we answer with, we literally don't know how to do anything else. We rip off a lot of your doctrines and cultural practices. Oh, and we will make our persecution complex the loudest, too.
And in some ways, Mormons come by it honestly. While we've mentioned the Great Exodus from Nauvoo to Utah wasn't exactly like Moses leaving Egypt, Mormons sure experienced it that way. I mean, I can distinctly remember an institute teacher laying out how Utah is just a mirror image of Israel. It was very detailed. And he turned out to be one of the bubbles on the leaked chart of dangers to the LDS Church, so there you go.
I just would love to see Brigham Young wearing Teva's sandals and a red robe like Chuck Heston. That would have been a look. So we downplay the suffering mostly because I don't need to hear about it at every holiday dinner in order to make me appreciate my Jell-O salad. But sometimes, jokes aside, the suffering was real. Let's just talk about some of the ways to suffer on the Mormon Trail. So historian Stanley Kimball, who is considered one of the experts on this time period, put together a good list of the risks, and we'll borrow from that. Because coming across the plains means you risked injury, sickness, and death.
These immigrants suffered cuts, gun wounds, broken bones, scaldings, animal, insect, and snake bites.
Stampedes, overturned wagons, shifting freight, which is now a fun TikTok trend now that I think about it.
You risked drowning, quicksand, black scurvy, black canker, cholera, typhoid fever, the ague, quick consumption, headaches, piles, mumps, asthma, inflammation of the bowels, scrofula, diarrhea, smallpox, the itch, infections of all kinds, and erysipelas. And I have to say, I proofed the Amos Alignment Trail diary, and there was this word that the editor could not make heads or tails of, and finally it hit me. It was erysipelas. He just didn't know how to spell it.
What is that?
It's a skin thing, and it's like it's not very pleasant, it sounds like.
Okay, and then if you're a woman, you had to deal with menstruation, childbirth, and so many complications like puerperal fever, bleeding, infections, and I don't know, the general discomfort that comes with being 8 months pregnant and sleeping in a freaking wooden wagon box. Now that I think about it, these are the perfect persecution complex components for a good sequel. No wonder Wilford Woodruff and Lawrence of Snow would have a hard time recreating an exciting quadrilogy.
Plus, the tech they were working with sucked sometimes. Mormons tended to not use trail guides. They were real DIY people, so they used their own crappy maps and equipment. They also used oxen primarily to pull, and if you've worked with oxen, sorry, Lindsay, you know they can be easily stopped or quickly stopped.
That's because they're so sweet and self-assured. We keep comparing the Exodus West to Moses leading the Hebrews out of Egypt. And when I was watching the best movie ever made, The Ten Commandments, I forgot that there's a scene where it shows the Hebrew slaves building a giant tomb for one of the pharaohs. Do you remember this? There's like this old woman who turns out to be Moses's mother, spoiler alert, whose slave job is to grease the bricks before they move them. And not only is her true identity as Moses's birth mom being risked of being caught, her own scarf gets stuck in the giant brick and she is almost crushed to death. And it's quite dramatic. And maybe I'm really grasping at mud straw here, but Mormon women crossing the plains face similar risks.
Yeah, if you're not careful, women's long skirts could get caught in the wagon or dragged under animals. And there were a surprising number of injuries from this. 5 years later, Amelia Bloomer would be writing, "No kidding, tell me something I don't know." Children also fell under the wagons and sometimes got squished. And then also they could just wander off and get lost.
I mean, let's talk about bloomers for just a minute, because bloomers start coming out at this time and it's considered like this feminist, like they didn't have the word feminist, but this like woke, they didn't have the word woke. This encroaching threat to women's dignity, because what was best was to have women wear no underwear at all and just layers and layers of skirts. And then the kids, you know, riding those wagon wheels. Can you blame them? That sounds like fun, to grab onto the spokes of a wagon wheel and see if you can get tossed around a little bit.
Now that's a roadometer right there. Little Billy went around 10 times. What's that, 6 miles?
You know, everyone knows a kid that would have done this. And that would have been you, Brian. You would have been that kid.
That's actually not me. I have a neighbor kid that would 100%, he would have invented that thing, I think.
And not to mention you risk being stepped on, gored, and kicked by animals. This was a common problem. And that isn't even talking about all the other factors you could suffer from, which is cold, heat, too much rain, too little rain. It was a lot. There was a lot of suffering. Here's more from Stanley Kimball, quote, "Some immigrants suffered from being physically or emotionally impaired. There were persons with various kinds of physical disabilities like blindness, inability to speak, and absence of limbs. Emotional disturbances range from the mild to the bizarre. The number of physically and emotionally disabled Mormon immigrants who attempted to cross the plains or whose guardians attempted to take them to Zion is surprising. Mormon immigrant companies probably started out with a higher percentage of disabled people because of their belief in the power of the priesthood and in miracle healing. It was a common practice among Mormon immigrants to request church leaders to give blessings to the sick and the injured, and sometimes people were healed. Many were not. Immigrants were also plagued by mosquitoes, chiggers, ticks, lice, gnats, bedbugs, fleas, flies, and other vermin. To these trials must be added the weakness of humans being under stress, which sometimes led to abuse of language, fighting, quarreling, divorce, stealing, selfishness, sponging, excessive harshness, and alcohol abuse.
Alcohol abuse.
What is sponging? Is that a BYU thing?
I was just going to say that. I was like, that's another euphemism.
Stanley Kimball.
This is like mooching, basically. It's like lazy people are just mooching off their neighbors. But this alcohol abuse, we have a word of wisdom. Wait.
You know what? Here's another gripe. I really resent that the early pioneers were just fine using the sauce as they were coming over the plains. That makes sense to me. You're cold? Shoot some whiskey. You're injured? Shoot some whiskey. You're struck with Joseph F. Smith's temper tantrums in your wagon company? Shoot some whiskey.
Or steal some whiskey if you're Hosea Stout, chief of police and head squirrel strangler.
Exactly. I'm sure the alcohol on the trail helped to numb out a lot of the suffering. So, why then, I ask, since Mormons are obsessed with historical accuracy, why then could we not take a little flask with us when we're on trek? It's so unfair, so inconsistent.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me. Well, it was good enough for my grandpa. It was good enough for my grandpa. That was good enough for my grandpa. That's good enough for me.
All right, let's get into it. It's time to really talk about the trek west. You are playing Oregon Trail, after all, except this game is called the Mormon Trail. It's basically the same thing, only the bullets are your testimony. And you can only carry 200 pounds of Gentile back to camp.
We're going to be pulling from Stanley Kimball's work a lot. He was obsessed with trails and personally traveled every trail he found mentioned in over 900 trail accounts that he also annotated. He's one of the experts on the Mormon Overland Trail experience.
Now, listen, guys. I know a lot of Mormons are bored with the trail experience since many of us, especially Americans, have been force-fed Overland Trail narratives every chance we got. But it really is an important time for Mormon history, and the Exodus helps to forge a cultural identity, and that still affects the global church today.
We've mentioned before that Mormons were not necessarily unique in the fact that they traveled from the East Coast to the West Coast. There were plenty of other settlers, entrepreneurs, traders, foreign interests, pioneers, invaders, whatever you want to call them, that invaded into indigenous lands in the Americas, But several scholars like Wallace Stegner and T. Edgar Lyon have identified things that made the Mormon migration unique.
Before we get into those, we should mention that Mormon migrating was always happening. As Bill Hartley eloquently noted, the migration happened, like we mentioned, in three acts. The first being the winter migration from Nauvoo to winter quarters that happened in February and March of 1846. The second was the spring exodus. Hartley believes and argues that's the main exodus where the majority of the saints leave Nauvoo to go set up winter quarters, and then the September exodus when the last struggling saints gathered and Nauvoo was evacuated. We've talked about that three-part division, but keep those acts in mind because they add to the uniqueness Lindsay's going to talk about.
Okay, here's T. Edgar Lyon's take on the unique aspects of Mormon migration that sets the Mormons apart from the other settler groups, other than the fact that they had the truth with them all along. First, the group was constructed of what you could argue are religious refugees. So the group's motivation to head west was largely, if not completely, manufactured out of Mormon theology. And another unique thing was the economic status of those migrating. Most of the people that were in the Mormon groups were very poor. They weren't entrepreneurs looking to find a new fortune out west or to strike the hot iron of opportunity. They wanted to secretly and not so secretly practice the P in peace.
Peaceful P practicing. You say that three times fast and Alfred Cumming appears in your mirror.
No, thank you.
Mormons also didn't typically hire professional trail guides. At this time, if you wanted to head west, you would hire a professional trail guide because, you know, you're heading off into the literal unknown.
So there's this great movie that doesn't get a lot of play called Meek's Cutoff. And if you've watched it, you're a friend of mine. It's really rough. It's this movie loosely based on Stephen Meeks, who was hired to take a group of settlers to Oregon in 1845. But he's like kind of a huckster and didn't actually know the way and ends up getting them lost.
Lose three days on the trail.
Lose 3 days, not enough bullets. Definitely not enough bullets. It's really grueling to watch, but it's worth it. And I think that there's like this 20-minute scene where we're trying to get this wagon up a hill and there's like no dialogue. It's just like 20 minutes of watching this wagon get pulled up this horrible mountain. And it's so intense. It's exhausting to watch. It's overland travel at close range, and I definitely recommend it. The pace is slow, just like it would have been in real life.
And the thing of the trail is what became a burgeoning economy at this time. Like we talked about in our Donner Party episode, with Hastings Cutoff, there's this active campaign by many different political and economic interests to motivate people in the East to come out West. The reality was, is really only the rich could afford it, which included hiring a guide. Mormons would cut corners where they could. Part of that was not hiring trail guides. A lot of these early church leaders were much more of the frontiersman mold than, say, intellectuals. So they weren't unfamiliar with the challenges they'd be facing, but it's still a bold gamble to set out without experienced trail guides.
And that's why, folks, we get a lot of Heber Kimball's terrible theology when the man could ride a horse. Did you know that about Heber Kimball? He was a good horseman. He should have stuck to that.
His wives would say, maybe practice lovey-dovey a little more.
Stegner points out that this issue actually helps transform just about every person who comes overland with the early Mormon migrations as rugged frontiersmen. You start out in a factory in England, but you make it to Utah? You're going to have learned some stuff about working for and against the land. And the migration turns people into pioneers. And it also really codifies an identity and unity of gathering that exceeded other motivations for people who were coming west. Unless you're a cow that can't gather, like last episode.
I like this idea of these British immigrants who, many of them are factory workers or other things, not a lot of experience with anything related to frontier life. That's a study that I think would be really interesting, is looking at some of these people who don't quite grasp all that they're getting themselves in for. And
the accounts of them weeping in their journals of leaving green England to come to
desert,
butt munch desert Utah. Yeah.
But that experience forges a culture of teamwork and organization that hadn't quite been there before. If you think about it, in New York, the early church, you have these people grappling with how to organize a faith, a church. Then in Kirtland, they start experimenting with how to organize cities and towns. Missouri, they organize this makeshift military. Then by Nauvoo, they start experimenting with empire building.
But it's really the Trek West that teaches them to organize a heritage. You have to organize wagons. You have to work together as family in groups. You have to suffer and struggle together. And each individual learns that if they don't put in the work, the whole group will suffer and in some cases die. And I think it's hard for modern minds to really grasp this idea that if you don't pull your weight with a group, then people will die. Remember last time when Greenhorn broke his axle and they all had to stop? That was a fairly rare case when it didn't really impact the group's outlook. It was just mainly an opportunity for a well-placed sick burn. Far more often, though, the stakes are really high, and out of that comes a sort of, I'm a ride or die for you. You're Mormon, I'm Mormon, we live and die for one another.
The pain inside don't let me sleep. I bit the hand from which I feed. Guilt inside gonna make me bleed.
The Trek West really is a bit messier than this, but for the extent of making it as simple as possible, we're going to say the Trek starts in 1846 and goes until 1869 when the railroad comes through.
Most people count 1868, but I like 1869 because it, you know, part of 1869 they were coming through. And we should note that not everyone could always afford to come west by railway, so the trail was still used up until the 20th century. But yes, for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to say the official cutoff for the main Mormon migration or gathering ends in 1869.
So that makes 23 years of overland travel that becomes, also, an economy of its own. Mormons really did rule the West in the sense they controlled for a good part of this time a lot of the routes to California. This gives them power, and as usual, that makes the government uneasy. Not without reason. Hey, Mormons, you sure do have a big portion of this very vital trail covered, don't you? How are we feeling toward Uncle Sam today? Is he still hanging by a thread? You know, that kind of thing. When Mormons set out on the Vanguard Trail, they weren't just interested in getting to their destination, but they also have to be interested in improving the trail conditions for all those that are coming behind them.
And as we said before, the journey started from WQ, Winter Quarters in Iowa, to what is now modern-day Utah, and the trail was about 1,300 miles long, a little shy of that. It was 1,200-something. And you'll get different estimates, but for all intents and purposes, we're saying 1,300 miles. The Iowa section was about 265 miles and really is already traveled by the folks who had left Nauvoo. And then the handcart immigrants and a few others who didn't migrate from Nauvoo would travel it in the 1850s and 60s, and of course we'll talk about them. And it was probably one of the more challenging parts of the trail for them. We've talked about it before, but it was muddy, swampy, and cold, all those mud holes from last episode. And most of it always fell within 50 miles of what is present-day Missouri. It's actually hard to trace the old trail now in Iowa because it's all settled and developed land.
Over 70,000 people would cross the trail during this Mormon exodus. It starts with Brigham Young's Vanguard Company, which we'll talk about very soon.
One cool thing I want to mention, and one thing I'm really proud about when it comes to my church as a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Did I say that right?
I think you're supposed to say it faster.
As a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is that the church database has chronicled data for over 61,000 of those 70,000 pioneers. Do you realize how remarkable it is that we have that kind of history on our people? I freaking love it. And another weirdo thing about my weirdo community, to learn about this period, I've spent the summer reading Overland Trail journals. Man, if Mormons don't love writing about their dreams, they were doing the artist's way before the artist's way was even born. I love how much emphasis Mormons put on their crazy-ass dreams. It's so weird, so dangerous. They put, like, such literal meaning, and I am into it. Anyway, back to the database. I'm linking it in the show notes so you can research your ancestor's name if they came across the plains.
This database is unreal. I use it all the time. They have that.
What would we do without it, honestly?
Oh, it's so useful. They have that, and they have the missionary database, which they've actually now combined, which wasn't the best idea, but those two together are, the amount of work that went into those is staggering. Really, really useful pieces. So in all, more than 300,000 people migrate west, so clearly those 70,000 Mormons take up a large chunk of the migration. So let's draw a map for you of what the trail looks like. Close your eyes, get your imaginary felt board cutouts ready.
So the first part starts from Nauvoo and cuts all the way across Iowa. The first stop is in Winter Quarters, and then you cut directly from WQ to Fort Laramie, and that's just straight through what is now Nebraska. It's almost a straight line. Then you go from Fort Laramie, which places us now in Wyoming, to Fort Bridger, which is right at the border of Utah and Wyoming. And from Fort Bridger, we have a rough mountain pass that takes you into the Salt Lake Valley, where the Saints are going to try and establish their Zion.
The trail follows along the north sides of the Platte River. And this is what sets Mormons apart on the map, because the Mormons will go on the north side of the river, and the other non-Mormon immigrants will go along the south banks of the river. The Mormon Trail crosses the Continental Divide as you move through Oregon Trail buzz sites, South Pass through Fort John and the Sweetwater River until you get to Fort Bridger. Can you hear the music from each of those places in your head? That was one of the great touches of that game. And all of this isn't called the Oregon Trail, though. It's called the Mormon Trail. Not the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Trail. Sorry, Brother Nelson.
Coming west was expensive. If you were properly outfitted, you'd have at least one good wagon for your family with a team of oxen. Of course, it doesn't work out this way for many Mormons, including and especially the hand carters, which will come up when we get closer to the 1850s. What we will be talking about soon, though, is the creation of the Perpetual Immigration Fund. It's a crowdfunding campaign that Mormon leadership orchestrates in the attempt to help converts coming in from European missions to come west. And boy, is it messy, messy, messy.
All right, here's where Stan Kimball's research is at its best. We're going to link to this massive 236-page historical resource study that he created on the Overland Trail experience in the show notes. But he notes there are several jumping-off points for the trek. You have Winter Quarters, which is Florence, now actually North Omaha in Nebraska, 1847 to 48, Council Bluffs in Iowa, 1847 to 1852, St. Louis in Missouri, 1852, Keokuk in Iowa, 1853, Westport in Missouri, 1854, Mormon Grove in Kansas, 1855 to 56, Iowa City in Iowa, 1856 to 57, Florence, Nebraska, 1856 to 1863, St. Joseph, Missouri, 1859, Genoa, Nebraska, 1859, and Wyoming in Nebraska, 1864 to 66.
And of course, with the railroad, Kimball notes that, quote, the Union Pacific Railroad began moving west from Omaha on July 10, 1865. Thereafter, Mormons took trains from Omaha to three different railheads: North Platte, Nebraska, 1867, Laramie City, Wyoming, 1868, Benton, Wyoming, 1868. And we're going to break down how we talk about the Exodus using a lot of Kimball's and Hartley's criteria, which is, between 1846 and 1860, the Mormons generally went west in wagon trains organized at different points of departure. Between 1855 and 1860, they experimented with hand carts. Thereafter, during the years 1861 to 1866, the Mormons switched to large ox team church trains sent out from Salt Lake City to haul immigrants and freight west. And finally, during 1867 to 1868, they came by rail and trail. Done with all the 1860s?
Listen, we're done with all this boring historical data, mumbo jumbo. Let's get to some exciting stuff. Let's talk about their gear. I know we all have the hots for those fancy Conestoga wagons you see in the westerns, but in reality, the Mormons used all sorts of things to come west. The most common were just their farm wagons. These wagons were about 10 feet long, covered with large waterproof canvas. The wagons had to be pretty flexible, obviously. They've got to cross rivers, they've got to go over really difficult terrain of all kinds, and then sometimes you'd have to take them apart and then put them back together. Often the wagon beds were caulked so they could float. Yes. Of course, I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that sometimes, both in Oregon Trail The Game and in Oregon Trail The Life, that meant you could tip over and lose a bunch of your crap in the river. They were pulled by a variety of draft animals, oxen if you were lucky and Lindsay was watching over you, horses and mules if you're in a pinch. These wagons were not for riding, however, so don't get lazy. On the Mormon Trail, they didn't always tell you you'd be walking the entire time. I mean, the Pioneer Children's song is very clear on this point, so personally, I don't see the issue. Most people had to walk alongside the wagons, and they would only be in them if they were sick and, you know, on the verge of death. When they arrived in the valley, often those wagons would be converted into temporary houses. We talked about that with Joseph F. Smith. Mobile homes of the time, if you will.
A note about oxen for just a bit, because you know I love my oxen.
Here we go again with the pro-oxen agenda.
Listen, they really are the perfect animal for the job. They are amazing. So let's start with that. They were big and strong, brave even. They didn't get flustered with a little mud or swamps or quicksand like some broke-ass horse. They were docile, easy to take care of. They didn't need expensive or fancy harnesses. And here's the kicker, they didn't taste very good. So you didn't have to worry about them being stolen and eaten. But because they are awesome, I should say that you could eat them if you had to, but you don't want to do that because they are amazing and that would be a monstrous thing to do. These are the animals you wanted to be walking next to while you headed west because they're really woman's best friend.
You tell that to Susan's washtub. The Mormons did take some tasty beef with them in the form of cattle, and then they also had other herds of animals. And these are the ones that caused more trouble because you needed grass along the trail to eat. Which meant, of course, every elementary kid knows this, you had to leave at the correct time of the season so that the grass wasn't first covered by snow, and then you went through enough places that would still have enough of this that you could herd your stock through later in the season.
Lord, this is my confession.
Can we talk about bone mail for a second?
Wait, like that vintage booty call thing? Thought we agreed we weren't going to talk about that.
Nice try. No, kids these days with their fancy schmancy email don't know about bone mail yet. So, we've mentioned a few times that along the trail, notes were left for other travelers. And this wasn't usually done with little pieces of notebook paper. First of all, paper is expensive, and second of all, it's paper. Doesn't do well on the trail. So Mormons like to sometimes write notes on scapula or animal skulls, giving it the name of bone mail.
Alright, here's this from Stan Kimball. An example of this sort of bone mail read, Pioneers double-teamed, 8 June 1847. Camp all well, hailstorm last night, fine morning, Thomas Bullock, no accident. Sometimes they would write things on rocks and boards. They tied notes to trees or left letters enclosed between two pieces of wood. A trail post office was sometimes created by just setting up a pole by the side of the trail, drilling a hole in it for a letter, then plugging the hole. I'm guessing Louisa Barnes Pratt would also think these makeshift post offices were laughable.
I have to say, I found an account of when the brethren were like in next to Laramie there in Wyoming somewhere, and they all write their names, Council of the Twelve, on a buffalo head school. Just out there in the middle of nowhere.
That is pretty cool. I have to think if you actually had an example of that as a collector, that just seems very cool. That's iconic. Then, after October 24th, 1860...
Wait, sorry, I do want to say one thing. It makes me think that if we go back to the Wood Museum, I know she has a buffalo head there, and I never paid attention to it, but after all this, I'm like, I want to know what that buffalo head is.
Tell William Clayton to stop complaining, T. Bullock.
It's that, or it's like Porter Rockwell's first kill or something.
Dude, I just wasted some guy.
Seriously, I want to know.
All right, so then in 1861, once the overland telegraph wires are joined in Salt Lake City, the Mormons then started using the telegraph, especially with church headquarters there in Salt Lake City. You can say what you want about Mr. Zero Game, but that guy is always thinking ahead to how jumps forward in the tech would be used for the Mormons.
I'm going to refrain from saying many things, but of course, Mormons, like many humans, like to carve their names on things, which is kind of sweet when you go to some of these sites and you can still see names carved into rocks or trees.
Except it isn't always that sweet. There's a reason why you're not supposed to do that on trails, and you carve your name all over things. Like the Colosseum in Italy, you stupid dude.
Did someone do that?
Yeah, that dude got in a lot of trouble.
Good, good, good. Well, okay, so here's the thing. First of all, it's not just bad art, because being in nature is supposed to be this immersive experience. And so a lot of people, turns out, go to nature to escape graffiti, not to be reminded by it.
It is kind of wild, though. You think about like people at Chimney Rock or Independence Rock. It's like, well, it's historical, so it's cool, but if some idiot does that today, we yell at him.
I did read an account on the Vanguard where they're up in the canyon where they're just destroying rock formations by Devil's Gate. Like they like put, they shoot the, they put some gunpowder at the base of it to see if it looked like a cannonball hit it. Like they were real bored.
Yeah. If we can't be killing too many buffalo, let's blow some formations up. So
just wait, we'll get to it.
Well, see, this carving stuff, it's not just bad for the environmental impact as well. Because if you carve your name into a tree, that can introduce diseases, bacteria, fungi, and, you know, you're just modifying God's design, guy. Stop it. But it's more to it than that. We're going to show how the Mormon impact was way more than just this ugly vandalism.
So think about it this way. You can't have 70,000 individuals with their hundreds of thousands of thousands of thousands of heads of cattle walking with all those legs and wagon wheels. It's going to be very disruptive to the environment. And I'll give you the most famous example of what I'm talking about, because when we come into the 1857 Mountain Meadows Massacre story, you're going to hear a lot of accusations about cattle poisoning. And the Mormons claim that the Baker-Fancher Party are poisoning their cattle. There's accusations of Indians poisoning cattle and Mormons poisoning cattle. Back and forth, everyone is poisoning one another's cattle. Not very nice.
You never hear about cattle poisoning other cattle. Seems like they would have just made that up too. Because the thing is, nobody was poisoning someone else's cattle.
I'm happy we're talking about this now because this is probably where the whole cattle poisoning thing starts. Special thanks to Joe Geisner for helping reacquaint me with the sources on the anthrax debate.
Did you say anthrax?
Yes, I did.
Anthrax like these guys? Also, the toxin, that's probably the worst Eminem rhyme in white rap history, and why did you have to tell me about that?
That can't be true. White rap history has a lot of terrible rhymes, but did you not know this rhyme?
I did not know. I know some Eminem, not a ton.
So did you Google it?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, not a good rhyme. It's a rough one.
In fairness to him, I'm not exactly sure what else you would rhyme with it, but find something else.
Also, like, this is why white people should not be allowed to use the genre of rap. Appropriate that from other people.
That is a really good, that exhibit would hold up in court.
Thank you. I agree.
Yeah. So anthrax has an important role in the history of the Trail West. And as we start talking about future conflicts, Mountain Meadows, whenever you hear about strychnine poisoning or arsenic poisoning, keep anthrax in your hearts. Wait, that kind of came out wrong. Keep anthrax metaphorically in your hearts.
Please keep anthrax out of your hearts and lungs and fingertips. Brian's right, because especially as we get closer to the Utah period, just a decade away, you guys, and the Mountain Meadows Massacre, you're going to hear a lot of accusations of people poisoning the cattle. Mormons thought Gentiles were poisoning their cattle. Gentiles thought Indians were poisoning their cattle. Indians thought Mormons were poisoning their cattle. Lots of math was being done to decide how far a barrel of arsenic could go into a water source. And I'm not kidding. They talked about this a lot, and it led to a lot of unnecessary conflict.
Like the Mountain Meadows Massacre, for example.
For example, yes. And the cattle poisoning accusations were a huge part of the inciting justification for the massacre.
And here's the thing, though, because all of this talk wasn't for nothing. Lots of cattle did suddenly die on the trail. And Hosea Stout was nowhere to be found. It's all very mysterious. It's very convenient for anyone who wanted an enemy to blame. Cattle were actually dying.
Turns out, though the Mormons were quite familiar with poisons, thanks Danites and Hosea Stout, none of these folks could know that the source of the poison wasn't spite, jealousy, or scarcity. It was actually anthrax from the soil that caused the problem.
Here's how it worked. Anthrax spores were stored in the untouched soil and dirt throughout the American West, but as all of these wagon trains start coming west, the cattle eat the grasses that contained the soil, and the wagon parties and all this motion kicked up dust, activating the anthrax spores, literally poisoning those who came across it later.
So, people weren't trying to actually kill one another's cattle.
Nope, it's just anthrax spores, the result of tons of immigrants disrupting the natural landscape. Western migration is the culprit. Well, boo, that's way less sexy than this rampant coordinated poisoning campaign.
I guess, though, that you could say that the Mormon Trail was literally poisonous? Huh. There's a terrifying metaphor for you. The devil he had won. He said to me, it's gonna rain down over me. Over me.
So, when you're playing Oregon Trail, because I know you are, do you ever start wondering what all those little NPCs are experiencing as they cross the trail?
I'm always playing the Oregon Trail in my heart. For Mormons and other immigrants, the routines were basically the same. Stanley Kimball observes, quote, "The basic trail routine, more or less observed throughout the migrating period, might be summed up as following. Arising, praying, cooking, yoking up, pulling out, nooning, when people ate usually cold lunches and draft animals rested and grazed, pushing on, selecting camps, gathering fuel, cooking, washing up, mending, recreating and socializing, rounding up stray livestock, milking, grazing the animals, praying, retiring, and standing guard. To this routine should be added washing, repairing wagons and equipment, hunting, dealing with Indians, conducting or attending religious services, and occasional birth, accidents, sickness, death, funerals, marriages, and quarrels." End quote.
I gotta say, nooning sounds like something that happens at BYU with those naughty, naughty co-eds.
I love this line, cooking, yoking up, pulling out, nooning.
Pulling out, nooning. He put them together. We didn't. That was Stan Kimball.
That was Stan Kimball. One thing that I think is fun is that even though they went along the trail, they still found time to do things that were fun, like tea parties. Sometimes they even hosted a wedding. They played a lot of games and danced a lot. Mormons of this period were especially known for their dancing, Brigham Young too.
I was going to say, how much would you give to see footage of Brigham Young dancing?
Can you see him put his little arm behind his back on those little tippy toes doing some little...
All of a sudden he starts twerking quadro. And you're like, okay, we're done. Shut down the footage.
You know he didn't have an ass. That man had the white man ass sucked back up into his soul, into the celestial kingdom.
It's a safe bet.
But he did like to dance, and as he told people later, which we'll talk about, he didn't let the dancing go to his head. Once the dance was over, he let the dance lay where it was.
We dance unto the Lord.
He didn't take the dance into any other thing in his life. He left the dance where it was. But Mormons like to dance. And women would bring some of their prized belongings with them on the trail and sometimes set them out of their wagon to mimic parlors back at home for these dances. And I think this is kind of cool because I would have been one of those. I would have been making my husband cart the freaking Chase Lounge inside and out of the wagon box to be fancy, to make a parlor around the campfire.
We're having the All Reds over tonight.
I would have been that lady. God, so miserable. These women would spread out rugs and lamps and other things to build a parlor scene. And they did this in the back of the wagons, too, because setting stuff out is important, not BYU nooning your pervs.
When it came to food, we'll say that most Mormons ate better than the kids today on Trek. Stan Kimball notes, quote, "Trail larders were well supplied, consisting of staples like flour, bacon, sugar, tea, coffee, beans, dried fruits, canned goods, salt, dried meats, vinegar, there we go, cheese, pickles, oatmeal, molasses, bran meal, eggs, butter, wine, whiskey, and other alcoholic beverages. In addition, Mormons sometimes had chickens, pigs, sheep, and milk cows. Such supplies were supplemented by whatever immigrants could gather or catch that swam, flew, ran, or crawled or grew. This included fish, turtles, clams, buffalo, antelope, beaver, prairie dogs, mountain sheep, squirrels, rabbits, snakes, bear, deer, elk, ducks, pheasants, quail, prairie hens, turkeys, geese, pelicans, yeesh, strawberries, cherries, grapes, currants, gooseberries, serviceberries, mulberries, chokecherries, plums, blackberries, wild pears, honey, and volunteer corn.
What the hell is volunteer corn?
I would never volunteer to be corn. You would have to order me at gunpoint.
I'd rather be a pelican. I'm glad you brought this up because in Mormon fandom, no matter what episode you watch, live through, or experience, persecution narrative is the key. It's the one ingredient that ties us back to the suffering of Joseph Smith. And Brigham Young understands this better than anyone. Remember this. He knew that the good components of a Mormon experience, he knew what the good components of a Mormon experience was, and he uses the trail experience to solidify that. While an estimated 6,000 people would die coming west over the 20-something year span, most of the trail experiences weren't all death and tragedy. They didn't starve and drink only chicken broth for days like our youth group did when we reenact a trek. They had gooseberries and pelicans.
The pelicans. Maybe pelicans are delicious, but they just sound disgusting.
Can you imagine killing one and then having to, like, prepare it?
Looking into the face of one of those things? Yeah, if you offer me pelicans, I'm going to say, no thanks, I'll take squirrel mess.
Pelican gels? Nothing?
No, pass, hard pass. Now, I will push back somewhat on this, we have all the food we want, based on the accounts that we talked about last time, because nearly every one of those women mentioned a good level of food scarcity. Now, I think some of that was a product of staying in one place for too long, because throughout history, you see many indigenous groups moving frequently to avoid exactly what the Mormons went through during the winter quarters era. Once they started moving, it seems like they ate well and traveled well, but they still extracted every bit of suffering they could from those experiences as a badge of honor for later. Don't worry though, we've also tried to recreate the suffering by keeping you in winter quarters as long as was humanly possible.
We'll link a paper in the show notes about Mormon trail mortality rates, because several censuses were taken on the birth rates and deaths of the trail.
Church historian Andrew Jensen tried to get some data on this when he started a project in the late 1880s and 90s that looked at a bunch of pioneer diaries. With the help of all the clerks in the historian's office, Jensen estimated that over the course of the entire migration, those 70,000 saints, 6,000 of them died on the trail. More modern estimates, like those from Susan Easton Black, put the number closer to 4,600. Our best current data estimates about a 3.25% mortality rate.
Apparently, the mortality rate estimate for the Oregon Trail is 6%. I know this messes up the stories that we were really persecuted and struggled coming west. Since pioneers were dying across the trail, no matter their religion, but were they all eating pelicans? That's the question.
If they did, it would have been 4 to 5%. Maybe 12.
That's a hard stats right there.
Sorry, if we have pro-Pelican agenda people out there, we're just going to apologize right now. But you know what? It's fine because your great-great-great-grandpa, who forced your grandma to smash her best china in Kirtland and was, of course, a bodyguard to Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, he definitely died on the trail, though. You're fine.
Did you feel it when he said that? Did you feel the hearts of your ancestors as you sipped on your milk soup and slept in your 3 months of unwashed hickory pants?
When you join us next episode, we're going to bring you finally into the Salt Lake Valley along with the American Moses himself, Brigham Young. You think Mormon fanfic was fun in Missouri and Nauvoo? Just wait till we hit the Utah period. B-I-G-P-O-P-P-A. No info for the DEA. Federal agents mad? Because the Books of Mormon's report is flagrant. Powered by Benchmark Books. Stan Kimball's Mormon history career had two main prongs. The first was Heber C. Kimball. He is a descendant, after all. He did a bio of him and then also edited his diaries. The second prong was all this work on the trails. We mentioned the historic resource study he did for the Parks Department on the Mormon Pioneer National Historic Trail. This was a pretty traditional overview of the whole experience, and this is actually online, so we'll link to it. Then later, he and his wife Violet co-authored a look at the social aspect of the journey called Villages on Wheels, A Social History of the Gathering to Zion, which was published by our friends at Coford. Get it, along with everything else in the Mormon universe, at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake or at benchmarkbooks.com.
wrong. Won't you sin destroying Danites, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.